At the turn of the 20th century, the city of Los Angeles, California, was taking off. More than 100,000 people were living there, and it just kept growing. And like all cities in the West, there was this question of whether there was enough water to support all of this growth. I mean, there wasn't actually enough water in the Los Angeles basin, so city leaders started looking around.
It starts in around 1904, which is when William Mulholland found Owens Valley and decided that it was a good place to take water from to keep the city of Los Angeles growing.
That's Karen Piper. She's written a book about the LA water story. William Mulholland was an engineer for the city, and Piper told us he had his eye on the Owens Valley, a couple hundred miles to the east.
Oh, it was stunning. You know, there's pictures from back in the 19-teens, and it's this, you know, huge lake that reflects the Sierras. And there was so much wildlife, apparently. So this was a major bird area. Of course, everything has changed now.
Mulholland had a grand vision, a massive aqueduct. Inspired by the Romans, it would divert water from the Owens River and send it to L.A.
And so they commenced to build this aqueduct that took water 233 miles from the north down to Los Angeles. That was the idea back then of like, let's just grow and grow. And isn't it glorious that we can do this in the desert?
It's 1913 when the water finally arrives in the city. November 5th, thousands showed up for an opening ceremony.
There was a big celebration and a rally, and there was enormous crowds come to watch the water pour down this staircase ramp. Then they also gave out little vials of water to everybody there to take home with them. And so when the aqueduct opened, Mulholland said infamously, "There it is, take it."
There it is, take it. It was a dramatic moment. And Piper writes about this sense of euphoria people were feeling about the water and patriotism. The Department of Water and Power put out this ad that said anything less than full support of their water project was treasonous. That was a word they used because they had found their water source. They could keep growing. And this made the city very wealthy. But Karen Piper told us, for those outside the city, this was a devastating plague. And it didn't take long for farms in the Owens Valley to dry up. They fought it at first. Some even tried to bomb the aqueduct, but eventually people just moved away.
It tapped into the river that fed into a lake, and that lake, Owens Lake, began to dry up. And as it dried, it began to emit this toxic dust that eventually became the worst dust pollution problem in the Western Hemisphere. It blew as far as Arizona and Los Angeles.
By 1926, Owens Lake was dry. And ever since, people have been contending with the consequences. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We've been thinking about the Owens Lake story this week because it's a cautionary tale for the Great Salt Lake, which we just learned is at its lowest level ever, since they've been measuring it anyway. And for those who monitor the health of the lake, this could be a critical moment because we may be quite close to a point of no return, where the lake becomes so salty or dry it can no longer sustain life. Because it's not a dead lake, folks, not right now. It's low, drastically low, because of drought, because of climate change. But the reason we're telling the story of Owens Lake is because the Great Salt Lake is also being depleted by these diversions of the river water that feeds it for growth and industry. And one of the consequences for those who live by the Great Salt Lake could be an incessant cloud of toxic and irritating dust. because that's what happened when Owen's Lake dried up. Karen Piper says she grew up breathing that dust. By the 1970s, Los Angeles City was desperate for solutions.
They wanted to layer it with tires initially because that was the cheapest way. Which, oh, and they sprayed some chemicals on it. They tried that to hold it down. So here's the situation. You have, once this dust becomes a big enough problem, the Environmental Protection Agency gets involved and says, like, you're not in compliance with air quality control laws. And so then it's up to the air pollution control districts to solve the problem. So you have this little government office in Owens Valley that's suddenly supposed to stop this whole disaster that's been going on for almost a century, no, 50 years back then. And what are they supposed to do? So what they did is they tried all these different things without water, you know, and because they had to, because the city controlled the water, and they figured out that they couldn't do it. So ultimately they sued the city, and these lawsuits went back and forth for decades, but ultimately they won, and they determined that Los Angeles was the source of the dust problem. So Los Angeles had to pay for it. And so that's when they were able to start getting serious about solving it, is when they got water. So all this, you know, as I said, went on for decades. But once they got water, they were able to start developing sprinkler system and planting salt grass. And those were the two most effective ways of remediating the dust. They didn't get enough water, so they also had to layer part of the lake with gravel. And they're, you know, and now we're in this massive drought. So the city's like, how can we keep giving water to a dead lake when we don't have enough water for us? So, you know, these conflicts are just never ending in the West.
You've written that when Owens Lake was drained and that water diverted to the city, that there was this, at first there was this sense of euphoria. What do you mean by that?
Just this sense of, like, we can grow and grow and grow. And this is what America is. This is how we prove that we're sort of meant to be here. Like, all our problems are solved because of water now. So we can do anything. You know, the idea of being able to just, like, lavishly waste water in the desert just feels like being rich overnight, you know?
What's the lesson here, Karen, in Owens Lake for Salt Lake City? Clearly, there's a cautionary story here, right?
I would say the lesson is to get started early on the project. I think with Owens Lake, people didn't even really, people in the city. Now, in Owens Valley, they thought about it all the time. Or in dust-impacted areas, they thought about it. But people in the city didn't really start thinking about how they're going to solve this problem until it had gone on for so long. And, you know, by then, all the, like, they never should have put those groundwell pumps in there. You know, if they hadn't, there wouldn't have been a problem. So start thinking early about every water diversion that is taken away from the lake, because right now, with this mega drought going on, you're fighting climate change on top of all the people that want to use water going into the lake. So you have to just protect that lake as much as possible now to keep this from happening.
Let me ask you, I want to get a personal dimension to this story, because you write about that in your book. You grew up with the dust in Ridgecrest, California. What's it like? What's that like, that dust?
It wasn't like a dust storm like you think of coming off the Sahara Desert or something where you're pitted with sand. It was more like a fog floating into the valley. You could watch it in the hills because you can see forever in the desert. You could watch it coming over the mountains to the north, like this wall of fog. And it was white, and then it would hit the city, and it would be like this almost like chalky stuff floating in the air, or I think I call it flour in my book. But it's even finer than flour. It's so fine that it just stays suspended for hours. Now, as a kid, I had no clue what this was. I was like, oh, it's fog, but the house gets dusty, you know? So it wasn't until later then when I found out that Owens Lake was causing it that I was like, oh, Dad, I want to go out there. Let's go see it. So we just sort of drove onto it and got out and walked around, and I would pick it up and feel it. And I describe it as being like a moonscape. It's all these craters and pockets of there's salt and then like little salt mounds everywhere. And when you can reach down and pick up these salt mounds and they just crumble into nothing instantly.
How dangerous is this dust?
Oh, yeah, that's another thing. You got to get on top of this in Salt Lake City, because the other thing with these dry lakes is they all have a sort of similar composition, which is that they have heavy metals in them. And it's just because of the rocks that surround these lakes. As they wear down, they have heavy metals in them that concentrate at the bottom of these lakes. And so, you know, you get arsenic and cadmium and all kinds of things there that are nickel and that aren't good for you. And with the kind of dust that they have, you breathe it in and it absorbs into your body. It's not something you just breathe back out. So you're absorbing these heavy metals, and heavy metals don't disappear. So you're going to keep that in your body for the rest of your life. So what do those heavy metals then do? Well, they can cause immunological disorders, all kinds of problems. So arsenic is bad. So these are just things you want to avoid.
How expensive is this to fix this, or at least deal with it? That remediation part seems extensive.
Think about Owens Lake is 110 square miles, and well, how big is Salt Lake, Great Salt Lake? And it's 1,700 square miles. So it's like over 10 times bigger than Owens Lake. So I'm sort of like, the cost, you couldn't do it. I mean, that's why the solution is just to keep the water in there, get water back in there, which makes everybody mad, because it means you have to cut back on irrigation, you have to cut back on, because it's not, individuals are always like, well, I should use less water, but a lot more of our water is going to industry, corporations, and to agriculture. So those are the two things, two places that have to start cutting back on water, and that makes everybody upset.
You said you could see the story here at Great Salt Lake. You could see it coming a mile away. Should we have seen this coming?
Oh, yeah. But yeah, because I remember reading about this at Great Salt Lake back in the 80s, actually. So the information has been out there. I know Terry Tempest Williams wrote about it. So, yeah, I mean, but it's like hindsight's always 20/20, I guess. But that's why I say start paying attention now, you know, before the dust gets really bad.
Yeah. Well, Karen Piper, thank you so much.
Sure. Happy to talk to you.
Karen Piper, her book is called Left in the Dust. So we're talking about the future of the Great Salt Lake today. Lindsay Whitehurst is a journalist with the Associated Press, and she's been covering this story. She told us this week, for those who live here, whether we think about it or not, we are connected to that lake.
In some ways, it literally defines our identity in the sense of the capital city is named for it, right? In other ways, it becomes like a lot of things that are with us every day, it fades into the background a little bit, right?
You take it for granted.
Yeah, that it's there, it's massive, but you don't really spend a lot of your time thinking about it. And one thing, of course, for people who live here, it's not always a pleasant seaside experience that you might imagine as an outsider. There can be the, you know, colloquial lake stink. You can sometimes have a smell which at certain points it smells like the ocean.
Yeah.
And at other points is less pleasant.
And
there was at least one study that found that is an effect of treated wastewater. It's actually pumped into Farmington Bay, which is one of the areas where it's closest to housing.
That's the smell.
That's what this study, I believe it was Utah State, found, that a big part of that smell is because it's treated water, so it's not literally stinky itself, but because even that treated water can have more nutrients in it, that contributes to that lake stink it has that reputation for.
Yeah. Let's talk about how bad it is, which I guess is the question. How bad is it? How low is it?
Well, it hit a historic low, 170-year low, just a few weeks ago. And when it hit that low, when I was reporting this story, I was told we expected to hit a low because it didn't get as much water as it typically did at the highest point. So we know when
it
should get a lot of water from rivers coming in, it should get, I want to say, about a foot, foot and a half. It only got like 6 inches. What I was told the big issue is that it's rivers coming in to the Great Salt Lake that should be putting much more water into the Great Salt Lake than they are. The Great Salt Lake is a terminal basin lake, is what they call it, that it doesn't flow to the ocean. It stops there, which is, you know, the big reason why it is so salty. And so people have been diverting water from the rivers before it gets to the lake for agriculture, for drinking water. And so there's not as much water going in. And that's the big thing that's been the consistent problem at the Great Salt Lake.
Let's underline that point because I think this seems really critical, because I think there might be a perception among some that this is a drought story or this is a climate change story. And for sure, those things are exacerbating an issue. But this is about, maybe not principally, but in an important way, about those diversions, right?
Yeah, and it's about all those things, right? That the diversions are a big part of it. But if we weren't in a drought, would people need to divert so much water?
Sure.
You know, if we weren't in a drought, would so much water soak into the ground from those rivers, right? If that earth wasn't so parched when that snow melt starts to come down. So all those things play into it. And like a lot of things, when we talk about climate change, a lot of it depends on us too, right? And what are we going to do? There was one study that found that diversions to the lake need to be reduced by 30%.
I want to ask you about that. So this was a Utah State study that you referenced in your piece, that if we're going to keep water in the lake, at least enough to sustain life there, we're going to have to decrease those diversions by 30%. Now, that seems like a lot.
That's pretty significant. And the other thing about it, of course, is the rivers that feed the Great Salt Lake, the Bear River is a big one.
Yeah.
It doesn't just flow through Utah.
Right.
It flows through Idaho. So it's something that could even need a regional way to think about some of these things. Because, a lot of it is agriculture, what it's used for.
Sure.
And so figuring out ways to work more efficiently on these things, figuring out ways to balance these really other real needs of people to make a living, to eat, and also make sure that the Great Salt Lake has enough to sustain itself. These are big things and sort of a microcosm of a lot of the issues when we talk about scarcer resources, when we talk about drought. It's a real balancing act.
I wonder what the political dimensions of this story are, how they're shaping up, because it seems like the kind of resistance you're going to start seeing if state leaders start proposing, 30% cuts in this water diversion. You've got farmers, you've got other stakeholders like developers and business owners who have said, you can't have the water you've come to expect. You have to cut back. How are they going to react? How are political leaders going to react? Do you have any sense of that yet?
I don't think that it's been something that's totally ignored. I do think it's something that people have thought about and that there are concerns about. If this stuff were easy to do, we wouldn't be in a climate change crisis as a planet, right? if these interests were easy to balance. I think that Utah is, of course, a conservative state, but I do think there has been a recognition among a lot of folks that these are issues we're going to have to deal with at some point. Whether it can be dealt with and prioritized before it becomes a crisis is kind of an open question. And this is where, even though the Great Salt Lake story is not just a drought story, right, some of the things that we're talking about with regard to the drought, and I do think that's been, you know, a big part of the conversation lately. There's been a fair bit of drought and wildfires and things like that.
It's gotten people thinking.
Right. Yeah. So some of these things, when we talk about the drought, they can't hurt. Right. You know what I mean?
Right.
When it comes to watering your lawn less, taking shorter showers, all of those are, pardon the pun, drops in the bucket, right? But having those conversations, it can't hurt. It might not be a direct, you know, A to B, especially mm-hmm. for the Great Salt Lake, but it could be a good starting point.
You wrote in your article recently that addressing this problem is going to require what you describe as a major shift in how water is allocated and diverted. Any idea what a major shift would look like?
I think the experts I would talk to, what they would say, I think, is that part of what we need to do to save the Great Salt Lake is shift the popular perception about the lake. There can be this idea that every drop of water that makes it to the lake is wasted. But I think that's one piece that's a beginning of it, is to think of the lake as something that's not only has inherent value, but has needs, and that they need to be met. It won't always be there, you know? And mm-hmm. so that shift in thinking can at least be a place to start.
Do you think people know the stakes? That is, mainstream Utahns who live within the path of the winds that could carry dust into their neighborhoods and all of the other consequences. Do you think most, like, rank and file Utahns get the stakes of what's going on out there right now?
I know I learned a lot reporting this story as a rank and file Utahn.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody who lives in the valley,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I had some awareness of some of these things, but I know that I learned a lot as somebody who lives here about this really truly incredible natural feature is sort of woven into our lives in ways that we might not be aware of, you know what I mean, day to day. So I think that
well, what you're saying is no. most of us don't really get this. I mean, you're a reporter. You went out and researched this piece.
Yeah.
Most of us probably don't know what's coming.
Some of this research, we're still at sort of the beginning stages of figuring out how serious the issue could be too. There, I think, has been in recent years a lot of really interesting things done, and there's a lot more to be done to figure out exactly the scope of the issue. And it's something that as we know more, that we'll just have to keep paying attention to, you know, and keep it as something that is sort of front of mind instead of something that completely fades into the background.
Lindsay Whitehurst, she reports for the Associated Press. We have a link to her stories about the Great Salt Lake on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listener support makes programming possible on KUER. You can easily manage your donation anytime with MyKUER. It's a place to go to update your contact information, find tax receipts, change the amount of your donation, or switch payment methods. For example, you can update that expired credit card with a direct donation from your bank account. Sign into your personal online donor profile at KUER.org/MyKUER.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Sure, the Great Salt Lake stinks sometimes, and the flies can be unbearable. And while the salt flats are a marvel, you can see why people think about it as a dead lake. But that lake is very much alive, at least right now. And it's also in trouble. At its lowest point in history, on a delicate knife's edge, Bonnie Baxter has been studying the lake and the ecosystem it sustains for some 25 years now. Baxter is a professor of biology at Westminster College, where she also directs the school's Great Salt Lake Institute. Now, she's not from here. She grew up near the coast in North Carolina. But it was when she started looking for a place to teach that she first discovered the lake.
I'd never been to Utah, and I told a friend in a yoga class, yeah, I'm flying to Salt Lake City for a job interview. And she said, you have to read Refuge. You have to read Terry Tempest Williams' book. and she brought me this book. I did make a mistake by reading it on the plane, which if you've ever read it, you don't want to cry in front of people on the airplane. But Terry Tempest Williams parallels the death of her mother with the floods of the 80s around Great Salt Lake. And I developed this love of this book and this ecosystem through that book. Mm. So I arrive at my job interview and have this interview, and I made a couple days to look around, and I asked everybody I talked to, like, I want to go out and see Great Salt Lake while I'm here. How do I get there? And like, nobody could tell me. They're like, well, you can drive by on I-80. And I'm like, oh, that's not where Terry was talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so there's this ecologist at Westminster, and he passed away a couple years ago, Ty Harrison, and he knew how to get to the lake, and he took me to the lake the first time. Mm. We went to Antelope Island. I remember the colors. I remember the reflection of the island. I remember the smell. I remember seeing birds I'd never seen before. Mm. And bison, holy crap. I mean, I'm from the East, right? Yeah. It was magical. It was just magical. I had an affection for it from the beginning, but I've always loved unusual places and unusual landscapes.
How do you describe the way the lake is connected to all of us who live here? You know, whether we think about it or not, how do you think about the way we are all in some way kind of deeply connected to that lake?
Yeah.
Are we?
I think we are. And one of the real different things about Great Salt Lake in terms of our connection to it as people is that this is a populated area. And most of these sort of terminal lake basins are not in a populated area. Mm. You know, we're in this metropolitan area with millions of people. This lake is our neighbor. This lake gives us snow. This lake helps control our weather. And this lake will send a dust storm into this valley. You know, these are vivid connections. And there has been a history of caring about the lake and not caring about the lake from people. And that history means there have been a lot of things dumped in the lake that may come back to haunt us. So the human connection to this lake, I think, has been both positive and negative. It's hard to have a family member that you can't say that about too, right?
Yeah. Let's go longer back.
Yeah.
And talk a deeper history.
Yeah.
One of the things you have written about is that the history of Great Salt Lake didn't start with Lake Bonneville, which I have to say is probably an idea that I've had.
Yes, all of
but
us.
You say
yes.
All of us, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
It's a remnant of Lake Bonneville or whatever. Yep. But you say, no, it's got a deeper history than that.
If you look at a hydrograph, which means water levels plotted on a graph, over 800,000 years, you will see four large lake episodes. And the last one was Lake Bonneville. But this basin mostly looked like this. It mostly looked like Great Salt Lake. And upon occasion, there were conditions like the last ice age where ice dams froze and allowed the conditions of the water filling up this basin. And so that happened four times over a million years. So it doesn't really make sense that we start with Lake Bonneville. That's just 30,000 years ago.
Why is that important? It seems like that seems important to you to say that this is – there's something – it's part of a massive continuum here.
Right. You can look at what is natural climatic change, and then you can look at what is anthropomorphic or human-caused climatic change. There's a difference. The Ice Age to the modern time, that transition – was a natural fluctuation when the Earth had a glaciation period and it came out of it. And we see that over time. We're not going back into glaciation right now, which we should be there, right? So when you look back in time, the Earth tells us a story about its history. And if you want to understand the story of this basin, you can't just start at some defined point because there happened to have been a big lake at that point, right? That's arbitrary. And there were humans here at that time. So there were people hunting around and observing Lake Bonneville and then moving down as the lake shores receded and brought more land to the people who were here.
So fast forward to the 20th century.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us of a certain age remember tourists, or at least talk of tourists sure. coming here and floating out there and saltwater taffy and all mm-hmm. of that stuff. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, concerts not that long ago. People have always given it a go out there.
Right.
But what happened? It seems like we're not as interested. Tourists aren't as – I mean, this sort of a novelty. But
right.
like what happened, do you think?
Yeah. The 1920s was an amazing time at the lake. The lake levels were up. Saltaire, this beautiful, ornate, amazing resort, was built. People were swimming and drinking and partying and having a wonderful time eating dinner out there. The train went to there from Salt Lake, so people could just hop on a train and go. The train took the big bands through there, so there was fantastic music. The 1930s, the lake dries up a bit. So then you see pictures of Saltaire in the 1930s and the lake is receding. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a normal cycle for terminal lakes to shrink and swell. And then there was a big fire at that Saltaire and it had to be rebuilt. And, you know, the current space was refurbished and redone after the floods of the 1980s. And so you don't really want to build on a lake that moves back and forth.
You can't count on.
It can destroy your property yeah. or it could recede and make your property worthless. And so I think that's been a saving grace. Otherwise, there would have been a lot of development because your average everyday lake has a margin which it keeps. It has inflow and it has outflow and it might flood or might, you know, be desiccated, but it will return to that margin. And that's not Great Salt Lake. It's meant to ebb and flow. That's what terminal lakes do. The only inputs of water are from precipitation or groundwater coming in. And the only output is evaporation.
Right.
So if you have more evaporation than you have input, then you shrink. And if you have more precipitation, then you have evaporation, then you swell. So it's a great place to teach the water cycle. You've got all of that, but it's natural for it to shrink and swell, as is the Dead Sea, as is Australian Salt Lakes, as is Mono Lake, these other lakes that are also in terminal basins. That piece is natural.
Right.
What we're seeing now is not natural.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to get to that because it seems like there's a difference we should draw between 1963.
Yeah. With a historic low before now.
Okay, so talk about that. What happens in 1963?
Yeah, so in 1963, it was just, you know, a low precipitation period of time. And
kind of a drought?
Kind of a drought. The causeway had been installed, so water's not flowing into the North Arm. All of this Wasatch snow runoff is going into the South Arm, when it makes it there, mind you.
Right.
So there was a low measurement at that time. But the lake quickly started to come back up, and it wasn't like we're seeing this unparalleled mega drought in the Southwest.
So the difference, obviously, I guess it's fairly obvious here, between 1963 and now is 1963, there's a drought. There wasn't climate change.
No.
There weren't all these diversions and draws on the lake.
We quickly recover from that. Right. Right.
We're in a different space.
We're in a really different space.
So it seems like the historic low condition of Great Salt Lake right now.
Yes.
Yes, we're in a mega drought.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's climate change, and climate change is critical. But what you're saying is that it's far more complicated than just climate change, that in some ways the diversions are as impactful on that low level of the lake as anything else, as climate change. Is that right?
The way I see it, we set ourselves up for failure.
Huh.
We did not set ourselves up to be resilient in the face of climate change.
So explain the diversions. Where are these coming from?
So largely, it's about agriculture. It's funny because we're not an agriculture state, but we do grow a lot of alfalfa that then often gets shipped to China. It's not like we're in the breadbasket of the United States. So that surprises.
But we do grow a lot of alfalfa.
Yes.
And this is where this story seems to sort of converge with the question of drought.
Yeah. And water right law.
Yeah.
Great Salt Lake was left unprotected because it was not a lake that gave us fish. All of the water standards set by the Clean Air and Water Act are related to bodies of water that have fish. So it's okay to have a high mercury level in a lake that does not give us fish.
Wow.
Right?
Is that unique?
It is unique for salt water. Yeah, because if it were marine, it would be protected, right? But it's the hypersaline nature of this lake means it's unprotected by that legislation. So that's why we have to set individual standards for this lake. We have to look at science about how much selenium is okay, how much mercury is okay in this ecosystem. So the other thing that means is that Great Salt Lake does not have its own water right. It's not respected as a body of water that needs to be filled. So if we can't get a water right for Great Salt Lake and we can't protect a certain level of water in the lake, that ecosystem will collapse and that will have devastating impacts for the humans, the millions of humans that live right here.
Can you take me through that chain?
Sure.
Take us through the implications of that. What's the cycle that happens? This happens,
yep.
Then this collapses,
yep.
Then how does it work?
Well, I think, first of all, I'll take you through the best case scenario and what we've seen and what we understand.
Okay.
We have a really healthy snowpack. The spring comes. It warms slowly here. The water trickles down through these rivers and creeks and this watershed and eventually makes it to Great Salt Lake. Mm. But if the lake shrinks and there's salt playa all around the lake and that makes dust, that dust lands on the snow. And that increases its ability to melt because it decreases what scientists call albedo or reflectivity. And it decreases
how white the snow is.
How white the snow is because the dust lands on it and it makes it dirty. So now the snow melts more quickly and it melts at a lower temperature than it would have before. So we get this rush of water coming into the valley. And the consequences is that the groundwater doesn't recharge. And water doesn't make it to the lake. It evaporates off the surface more quickly.
There's not time for it to absorb.
That's right. So without that nice trickle coming down into the valley, the lake doesn't fill. So then the lake shrinks more. So you get more dust. So you get more mistiming of snow melt. So you get less water to the lake. And then you get more dust and you get less water to the lake over and over again. So it's a negative feedback loop. And we've already started this, right?
So we're already in it now.
Now combine that with increased temperatures predicted from climate change.
Right.
So now you're talking about a system that doesn't work anymore. And what do we address? Do we address that we can't divert this much water? We need to give Great Salt Lake a water right? Do we address the brine shrimp as the key species? As the lake shrinks, the water gets saltier.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Because you concentrate the salts. Well, brine shrimp will reach a point where they can't tolerate it. Okay, so why should I care about sea monkeys, right? If we were to look at a really simple food chain in Great Salt Lake, 10 million birds come here to eat a variety of invertebrates, but in particular, if we're talking about the open lake water, brine shrimp and brine flies. This is the largest, most important body of water on the Pacific Flyway. This is the most important stopover for birds to get here, eat, get fat, and move on their merry way, right? So maybe you care about the birds and you care about this ecosystem collapse and changing their migration routes and all of these things. But, okay, maybe you don't care about sea monkeys and maybe you don't care about birds. Maybe you care about the lake generating snow for skiing. We're going to see not only the brine shrimp industry collapse, but the ski industry collapse. So maybe you care about that. I mean, maybe you care about the thousands of jobs that this creates. Maybe you care about the economy of the state. Maybe you don't. Then maybe you care about the air quality because as this lake shrinks, more dust will be created and we will have a devastating situation.
Is Dust Bowl overstating it?
No, Dust Bowl is understating it.
Really?
Because it's a terminal basin that has held the waste products of hundreds of years. So there's heavy metals out there.
This is the crap we've dumped there.
Yes. The crap we've dumped there will become airborne. So that is the worst case scenario. That's the Mad Max scenario, right? And I really think that's the trajectory we're on. So we have to get our head around this now. We have to figure out how to get beyond this.
Bonnie Baxter, she's a professor of biology at Westminster College and the director of the school's Great Salt Lake Institute. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help? Donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything, from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about the future of the Great Salt Lake today, which is now at its lowest level in recorded history. Researchers like Bonnie Baxter, a molecular biologist at Westminster College, are trying to determine just how long we've got before the lake becomes so salty or so dry, a wave of cascading disasters will kick in. And one of the big questions is whether the state's elected officials truly, you know, understand the science or the stakes of this story, and whether there's the political will to save the lake. Back to Dr. Baxter.
I think recently the legislature has done two really good things. And one is this HCR 10, this House resolution from 2019, that is basically a proclamation that the lake needs to have water in it because it will be devastating if it doesn't. And it's a baby step. There's no funding behind it, but it hopefully is a building block that, speaking to you state legislators, that we can build on next session. The other thing that they did last year was they set funding out for a position for a state coordinator for Great Salt Lake that would pull together all of the state agencies that work on various aspects of Great Salt Lake. That position could carry some weight in the Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands. They have a mandate to oversee the comprehensive management plan for the lake. We've been working on a technical advisory group to that agency to establish a salinity that is the tipping point for Great Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. Having those scientific numbers, basing this on keystone species, that if these don't exist, the lake will collapse as an ecosystem.
How close are we to the tipping point?
It's possible that we reach that tipping point by November of this year. Yes. It's
really?
Terrifying. Yes. We're about 2 feet in lake elevation from reaching a point where the foundation of this ecosystem will be decimated. We were at the lake about a month ago, and we study these stromatolite structures on the bottom of the lake that basically power this entire ecosystem. They do photosynthesis for the lake. They're really amazing. Mm-hmm. But they're only in shallow water because they have to receive the sunlight. The brine shrimp eat off of them. The brine fly larvae eat off of them. And then all of the birds come to eat these invertebrates. So if they become dead, there will be a loss of enormous magnitudes to the food chain. We noticed that the deepest structures only had 1 to 2 feet of water on top of them. And we're guaranteed to lose a couple feet of elevation before the low point of the lake of the year, which will be around November. If those structures are completely out of water by the end of this year, we are dreadfully close to a place where this ecosystem cannot recover. Because those structures take hundreds of years to build. We can't just give them some water, you know, in a couple years and expect for them to be revived.
So the governor comes to you and he says, mm-hmm. Bonnie, what do we do?
I say, get some water to the lake. It's not my job to tell you how, but you've got to get some water to the lake. As a scientist, I can't be an expert on water right law. I can't be an expert on diversions and damming and lobbyists for those. I can't be an expert on the Bear River pipeline proposal, which was passed by the Utah legislature but has not yet happened, and I hope will never happen. I hope it will never be funded. And I also can't be an expert on the water ethic in the state. The fact that we have green lawns in Salt Lake City is terrifying to me. I mean, there are very few arid places you go where people have decided that I'll have green grass instead of good air quality. I mean, that's the decision we're making. You know, what I would say to our legislators is that we need to intervene to protect this lake or we will see the death of this ecosystem. And we don't have much time. We really don't have much time.
Last November, you wrote an obituary.
Yes.
For Great Salt Lake. And reading it, it's really sad. Here's how you begin the piece. Great Salt Lake experienced her final glimmering sunset today. So you wrote it as if it was gone.
Yeah, yeah. So my co-author, Jamie Butler, and I, we had read an obituary for the Great Barrier Reef that was published in Outside Magazine a few years back. And at that time, we said, you know, this would be something we should write about Great Salt Lake. And it would be really shocking to people. And it would maybe make people care about it. And so we had it in the back of our minds for a long time. And things just started getting so bad with the lake elevation last year that we reached out to Catalyst Magazine and said, we really want to get this message out. Would you let us do, you know, write an article on the decimation of Great Salt Lake ecosystem? And their editors had no idea that this is what we had planned. So we sent it and said, I know this isn't exactly what we told you we'd do, but what do you think? And they really thought it was poignant and thought it was important to get the word out. I publish a lot of scientific papers that most of your listeners have not read because they go to a very defined group of academics. I think it's really important that scientists do work like this to get the word out and that we talk to legislators and that we talk to the public about our work. It's really, really important. And I'm not known for being poetic. I'm pretty direct. So it's a really different kind of writing for me. But it flowed out of us because it's emotional. It's emotional for us. And it's real. So, yeah, we researched how to write an obituary, and we wrote it as if she was a woman that we knew. And we knew what she had contributed to her village, and we knew how to talk about that. And so it just flowed once we started writing. It was heart-wrenching.
Yeah. Let me ask you, finally, you know, when people talk about the lake, people who've lived here, they know it's there, but it's stinky and smelly and full of flies now, and we don't get it anymore. It seems like that. Do you think that if we're going to somehow fix this, mm-hmm. we're going to have to value that lake in a different way?
Yes. Yeah, I do. There was an article in Scientific American in the early 1900s that called Great Salt Lake a dead sea. And even the Dead Sea is not a dead sea.
Yeah. So not dead, right?
So not dead. So that reverberated. And also the white people that came to this valley in the late 1800s were seeking a religious refuge, and having a Zion that somehow matched with locations in the Middle East also kind of felt right. And so calling it a Dead Sea was the same thing as having a river called Jordan and having, you know, a place called Zion, right? Mm-hmm. But it wasn't treated like the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea has really been honored over time. And the people, not the indigenous people, but the white people who moved here and took over the indigenous people's world, I imagine if I was one of those people, I would have been angry at a giant lake 80 by 50 miles that gave me no water and no fish, and I'm living in a desert. I can see how you'd have a love-hate relationship with this lake. The Goshute had learned how to live alongside it. They had learned how to farm the desert. They knew the capacity of the land. And people who had moved from wetter places in the world didn't have an understanding of that. So I can see how people would develop a bad relationship with lake. But I think that kind of hung over for a while. It was easy to send sewage waste into there. And I think, again, bodies of water were valued because they gave you water to drink and they gave you fish to eat. This lake gives us something different. It's an amazing place.
Bonnie Baxter, She's a professor of biology at Westminster College. She also directs the school's Great Salt Lake Institute. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.